All right, this is an interview with Anthony Sipe of Ada, Minnesota. The date is May 18th, 2005. This is a phone interview that is being recorded. Mr. Sipe, you do understand that this is being, telephone conversation is being recorded?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Now, you belong to Company K of the 337th Infantry Regiment, is that correct?
That's right.
All right. I'm going to start with some questions before the war started. What was your life like before the war? For instance, where did you live? What did your parents do? What was your livelihood like? Things like that.
Well, after I graduated from high school, I had a job working in a general merchandise store that sold groceries and hardware and farm machinery. And
what year did you graduate from high school?
1935. And then I worked there for about 2 years in 37, then I accepted a job in the bank as a teller, janitor, a cashier type deal, and I worked there pretty much for a couple of years, and then I took a little short leave there and back into the grocery business and on my own, and that didn't work out too well, so then I, after I registered for the draft, which was, I think, in October of 1940.
Were you married or single at that time?
I was single. And then I went back in and worked in the bank, and the bank itself up and moved its charter to another town about 40 miles away, but I stayed there in the bank building and ran a, what you call, sort of an exchange and insurance agency for in connection with the bank in Ada, Minnesota, and when I was drafted in the May 1st of 42.
So you were drafted before the war started then?
Yeah.
Oh, May 1st of 42, excuse me.
42, yeah.
42, okay.
Yeah. And, well, my father was a blacksmith by trade, and we also operated a pool hall and beer parlor in connection with that. And as boys grew up, there was six boys and four girls in our family. And we took turns helping in the shop and in the pool hall and whatnot. And then two brothers that went into the service before I did, Louis Sipe and Raymond Sipe. And
what branches did they go into?
I think Louis was in the tank outfit, and Raymond was in, I think, Air Force. Defense.
Right.
In Hawaii, I think he was. And, let's see. Yeah, and they both went in, and they were in longer than I was, and they both came home, and neither one of them were wounded or anything during the war. But anyway, during this time of the war, our family was pretty well broken up then. The girls were married, the men were all working and whatnot, and so the family and such home was disorganized and discontinued and such. So actually, during the war, I lost my home. But I got ready to start coming home, my older brother and his wife offered me an opportunity to stay with them until I found a job. And then I found a job and started working as April 1st of 1946 in the bank here in Ada, and I've been in the bank there ever since.
Great. Prior to the U.S. entry into the war, did you or your family have What knowledge did you guys have of the war and the and what was going on before the attack on Pearl Harbor?
Well, the only thing we had there, of course, knows was by radio and the newspaper.
Did you, were you following the war in Europe?
Well, certain amount of it, yes.
To what? To a certain amount, just kind of
passive
interest?
Just kind of keeping an eye on us. When I got called, I had some sort of an idea of what was going on, yeah.
So you thought that it was inevitable that the United States was going to get involved in the war?
Oh, yes.
Okay. How did you feel about the prevailing isolationism in the United States at that time?
Well, I don't know. At that time, I guess, the day I registered for the draft, I was ready to go. But I took about almost a year and a half before I was called. I realized that the United States was going to get involved in it and going to have to get involved in it in order to carry the thing through to finish off Hitler and his boys.
Where were you when you found out that Pearl Harbor was attacked?
That's a good question. You know, I that once in a while when I give a talk some places about where were you when such a date, and we had a bank banquet, in fact, on Pearl Harbor Day a couple of years ago, and I asked that question, and I forgot to tell them where I was. But I was in my car. It was on a Sunday afternoon, and I was taking my then girlfriend back to Fargo, North Dakota, to college. She'd been home over the weekend, and was riding down this main street in Fargo there. Broadway had the radio on in the car, and that's when I heard it.
What was your reaction?
Well, I guess at that time, nothing spectacular. So it was just getting that much closer to it, that's all.
Right. What was kind of the general community's response in Ada? What was the kind of feeling that was going on when the community found out?
Well, I think for the most part, the people in this part of the country are pretty level-headed, and they were supportive of the United States in this deal 100%.
Right. So when you got your letter in May of 1942 that said that you'd been drafted, what was your reaction at that time?
Reaction to what part?
To finding out that you'd actually been drafted and that you were going to have to go off to basic training.
Oh, I don't know. I was like I say, I was ready to go the way I registered for the draft. And so up until that time, it was just a matter of waiting to when my number would be called, yeah. And I had no thoughts of being doing otherwise.
And how did your friends and family feel? I mean, you mentioned you had a girlfriend. How did she feel about it? How did your family feel about you going off to...
Well, I guess, like most families did at that time, they hated to see anybody go, but they figured it was necessary, and... there wasn't anything you could do about it, and it just has to go and make the most of it.
And you went to Mississippi for basic training, that's correct?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I've read in some of your stuff here, but I'd like you to put it onto tape, some of the stories of basic training, but what was it like going from Minnesota down to Mississippi?
What was what?
What was it like going from Minnesota down to Mississippi?
Oh, well... When I was called in, we went to Fort Snelling, Minneapolis, Minnesota, and I got a 30-day furlough immediately to go home and straighten up my business in the bank and insurance agency before I went back. And those that went were sent out from there right into the service, went out to Fort Lewis, Washington, I think. And that didn't sound bad at all. And then when I come back and ended up going down to Mississippi. I thought that was the worst hellhole you could go to. But and there was only one other person that from my area that was involved in going down there too. But he was with the 339th, I think it was, and never got to see him too often there. But once we got down there and seen what the situation was, that everyone there was drafted. It was one of the first division of all selective service people that saw action. And that's the reason we stayed together for about 2 years before we went into action, because we started, the whole group started from grassroots to nothing off of Main Street and right into the war, yeah.
Right.
And I made up my mind, of course, once I got there, it was a different kind of world. It was about the time the movie Tobacco Road was going strong. It sure looked like it, yeah.
Right.
But like I say, I made up my mind then and there that I was going to make the most of it, and as long as I was there. And we were getting $21 a month pay at that time, and which wasn't very much. And of course, if you wanted to get any more, you had to get promotions and so forth. But about 2 months later, I think it was around the 1st of July, the government changed the pay scale to $50 a month. So that helped a little bit, but I still, like I said, did everything I was asked to do and a little bit more, and because I was gonna make some grades while I was there, because the field was open, and as I indicated there, I went from buck private off of the streets to first sergeant in 16 months.
Oh, wow.
Which was unheard of.
Yeah.
And after I got promoted to first sergeant from a buck sergeant's rating, at three jumps, where the regulations came down that there'd be no more jumping grades.
So what did you have to do to get promoted?
Well, the first sergeant that we had was a Mexican, Spanish, and didn't talk to fluent. He was a regular army man, of course. There was about six or seven regular army guys there that when we first started to help start training, they knew what was going on, and he was the first sergeant. He typed like he talked. He wasn't too plain, and I was one of the very few that could volunteer that knew how to type. I taught myself how to type when I was in the bank business, and so I got in the orderly room, command post, and helped with all of his book work and stuff that he had to do, and typed up his stuff for him, and run the errands for him and whatnot like that, was mail orderly, distributed the mail when it came in, and worked myself up gradually until just shortly before we were going to be shipped overseas, and he was discharged with medical discharge. He'd been in the service over 20 years. And so he got discharged, and that's when I got promoted to take his place, because I was doing his work to start with.
Right.
But like I say, all in all, it was probably what I thought was the worst place to go in my life. It turned out it was one of the better moves I made.
Right. Now, Mississippi must have been an entirely different culture from Minnesota. Have you ever been to Mississippi before?
No, I haven't. No, it was really, really something different. People, it was everything was segregated at that time. You go to the town, there was only certain restaurants you could go into, and things like that, theaters, and I know one time, well, this was on the Post, they had a show. big show tent there that showed movies. And we were in line with another guy from down south. And standing in line waiting to get our tickets. And we got up, it was long lines at that time. We'd probably block long some of them before the show started. And getting up close to the head of the line. And he looked around and he says, "Let's get over in this other line." I said, "What's for?" I says, "These were almost there." He says, "Well, look over there." He says, "There was a colored boy standing in that line." And I says, "That don't mean nothing to me." I says, "I'm not moving. I'm going in here." So we stayed in line. But this is some of the things that it was amazing to see that things like that still happen. In fact, on the when I came home on a furlough and on the train and was going along on the train, and the conductor come back in there, and this was a little old lady. She looked like she was about 80 years old, sitting in the back row. And he went back there and he grabbed and he says, "You SOB," he says, "You get back in the car where you belong. You don't belong in here." He took and shoved her in the back into another car on the train. But that was the life then.
Yeah, right. Now, in your unit, you probably have people from all around the country, correct?
Quite a bit. Mostly from the east and south.
East and south.
Yeah.
What was it? And now, had you traveled a lot before?
No.
So what was it like meeting people from all around the country?
Well, it was very educational, that part of it. And it was found and generally admitted by many that the best soldiers in the outfit came from the Midwest. Minnesota, Iowa, Nebraska, in this area. There was several people from the south in the line there, and most of them were from Pennsylvania and New York area, I guess, and then down the Carolinas, and down, I guess, some in Florida. But take some of those from down in Kentucky and Tennessee and Louisiana and down in Mississippi. They were a little slow learners, shall we say.
do you have an example of how they were slow learners?
Well, one of the guys with one of our platoons, the platoon sergeant had to take a piece of chalk and put an X on his left foot so he knew which foot to step off with.
Really?
And that's the truth. But and I had another party one day when I was putting up the rosters for, had to help post the rosters for guard duty and KP duty and whatnot. And this one fellow came up and he says, "Is my name on there?" I said, "Well, there's a list, look and see." And he said, "Well, I can't read." So I had to read it for him. And then another time, the same fellow, I put him on guard duty and told him about it. Well, he says, "I can't go on guard duty." I says, "Why not?" I don't know the regulations. I says, "Well, read the book." "Well, I can't read." So I just couldn't even put him on guard duty.
Hmm. Wow. And you say the guys from the upper Midwest were the kind of the best of the bunch?
They were the best of the bunch, and they're the ones that usually made the grades, yeah.
Okay. So they were the ones that promoted then, is what
yeah.
you're saying. Okay. Was basic training what you expected it to be, or...?
Was it what?
Was it what you expected?
Well, yeah. I suppose I have to admit that with my duties that I was doing, and that I didn't get in on all of the sessions of physical training and stuff like that. But I did get in on a lot of it, on the drill stuff and bayonet practice and stuff like that, hazard training. But I was probably fortunate that I didn't have to go through all of it, but we went on hikes. I know we went on a 25-mile hike on Easter Sunday with a full pack, and I was in the ranks then on that. In fact, the company commander offered me a ride in the jeep if I wanted it, and I told him no. I made the trip, but there was about 25 of them that didn't make it.
Oh, really? They just couldn't do it because of the heat, or?
Yeah, they fell out, and they had to go back and make it another day.
So, do you have some stories from basic training, or some, you know, a story that you remember the most, or?
Well, I don't know. We had one guy, he was Irish descent, and I don't know, probably wasn't too thick between the ears either. But anyway, we were taking rifle practice and what they call triangulations. They have a box sitting out there, and somebody out there sitting there moving a triangle around, and he's taking dummy runs at it, no ammunition, to aiming and pretend you were firing. And this one went along pretty good, so all of a sudden a bang. It was a bang went off, and here this guy had a round of ammunition in his rifle, and he doesn't know how it got there. and the captain, of course, jumped him right away. Oh, be gory now, wait a minute. But basically, I guess weren't too many. I know I had one guy that... he was in on sick call printed every day, so I had to register those that went on sick call on the morning reports and send them to the dispensary, and they come back and put them back to duty or confine them to the quarters, whatever the doctor's orders were. Anyway, he came in one day there and they wanted to get sick, so book, and so I put his name down, wrote the serial number down there. Well, how come you know about the serial number? I said, well, you're here every day. I should know it pretty soon. And another time, this is shortly after he'd been there, and on payroll there, you got paid cash. And one of the lieutenants was the payroll officer that goes down to get the money from the bank and bring it back and then count it out and pay everybody off. And of course the payroll was set up so that there's so many nickels, dimes and quarters and whatnot so that everybody would get the exact change. Well, they didn't realize that, I guess, and somebody come in and had some odd money come in, they'd give them some other coins or some other folding money. And it never came out. Even in the end, they had to borrow and get change from somebody. And so I told the captain one day, he said, let me do that. I said, I'll make it come out for you. So the next time they had the payroll come, I did. I went because I worked in the bank. I knew the guy had 17 cents coming. He had a nickel and two pennies coming, you know, and not... three nickels and two pennies or something like that. And it came out, but they never put me back on the again to help them out because it was the officer's duty to do it.
How was military life different from civilian life? I mean, because this is a period, you know, basic training is a period where you're going from civilian existence into a military existence. Was there anything that struck you about how different life was?
Well, not too much, except for the fact that you had your dining hall and you all had to go and sit down and at the table and eat there, and somebody said, pass the beans, you better pass the beans, and that's something, take some before they got them. and of course they had the community showers, or you had a group of 6, 8 of you taking a shower at the same time, and
how was the food, out of curiosity?
Well, the food was pretty good. There was, I guess we would call it goat stew quite a bit. Lamb, I guess, whatever it was, and a lot of ham, and as a whole, the cooks did a pretty good job on with what they had to work with to do it. And if I have anything left over, one guy was the mess sergeant who was in charge of the whole thing. Got caught taking some ham home. He lost his job and gave him a rifle and get out on the range. So I didn't pay him to do a thing like that.
How did you feel about being away from home?
Well, I didn't mind that part of it. I guess the first 3 weeks probably felt like 3 months, but after a while, I got used to it and didn't mind it. Yeah.
Did you keep in regular contact with people back home?
Quite a bit. So I still had a girlfriend and ran back and forth, and the folks, of course, dad and sister at home at that time, and some of the other friends that I had, I used to exchange greetings with every once in a while.
What did you do for recreation during basic training?
Well, there's when we were in camp in Mississippi, there, we did play some softball. I know, and I used to play baseball for a while too on the side. I played little kids with baseball, and of course there's always card games. And when we were overseas, back off the line in the rest area, that we had quite a little horseshoe pitching, and some softball, and on one occasion, near the end of the war, maybe after the end of the war, I don't remember exactly, but we were in a rest area, a rest camp, and they had a volleyball tournament going on with the officers, I guess it was, mostly, and the officers in my company, they were shorter guys, so they drafted me to play volleyball on their team. And it was on the sandy grounds too, yeah. And our team won, and we won. I think we won 10 cases of beer.
Oh wow!
First prize. And the officers were pretty good because they really brought it back to the company area, and let the rest of the troops have a hand in it too.
Oh, that's great. Is there anything else that you want to say about basic training before we move on? Or?
I guess one 4th of July, I think it was. It must have been the first 4th of July that we were there, probably. And they had a big review that they set up, and President Roosevelt came in the camp and reviewed the troops.
Wow.
But I didn't get there because I stayed back to guard the company grounds.
Oh no.
But I saw him drive by anyway.
Oh wow. Do you feel your training prepared you for combat? I mean, did you feel you were mentally prepared and physically prepared?
Oh, I think I was anyway. Some of them probably had a little trouble, but I know I took it as good as anybody, I guess, what happened and what I saw and happened. And I all in all, I was only scared once that I recall that I ever was really scared. And that was when we were overseas, and word came down that we were going to make a beachhead landing by Terracina, which was before we get to Rome, and the word came down that night that we were going to make a beachhead landing at Terracina, sort of like another Anzio beachhead type thing operation. And it was really dark, and we were marching up the line to get in position, and the roads there weren't kind of terraced roads inside the hill, you know, and just enough room to walk between the tank and the wall, and I always hated water. I never learned to swim, and this bothered me. And we were going up and working up there, and we finally got to the safe place we were going to stop, and we got my group happened to get a house that we occupied. And I laid there that night, and I just shook. And next morning, the word came down that they changed their mind. We didn't have to make the landing.
So you were more scared of the water than you were of the bullets.
Yeah, that's right. But as far as in combat and that, it never really bothered me much, because just made the most of it. But I had when we were on the line one time, we had one of the guys that blew his top out of the foxhole on the front line there, and they brought him into my area to find out what to do with him. So I took him and quieted him down a little bit, and I sent him to the medics. And another time, there was a group marching past us to the front lines, and he was hollering, you know, "I don't want to die, I don't want to die," this type of thing. But I don't know whatever happened to him. He wasn't with our unit anyway. But I say, all in all, I can't say that I was ever really scared. I just felt that I was in good hands.
Good. Now, you went overseas on a British ship, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, what was the name of that ship again?
It was HMS Andes was the name of it. It was a Majesty steamship, I guess, the abbreviation for it.
Right.
It was a converted British cruiser, and there was 5,000 of us on the boat.
Oh, wow.
And we were down right close to the kitchen. So if you didn't get sick from anything else, you get sick from the smell of the kitchen. It took kind of 9 days to go across then to Casablanca, and I was seasick 9 days. We could only get out of, only get out of the hole about a half an hour a day. I was up on deck to get some fresh air.
Now, did you know where you were going when you got on the ship? Or?
No, we didn't. No, we didn't.
When did you find out? When and how did you?
I guess it was told after I got out in the water, I guess.
And you went to Casablanca for
it? Yeah. Okay.
And what year was this? What time was this that you arrived at Casablanca? Pardon? When did you arrive at Casablanca?
Well, we sailed off on New Year's Day, January 1st, 44.
Okay.
And it took 9 days then to get to Casablanca.
What was it like when you got to Casablanca? What was your impression?
Oh, Jesus, that was a different world entirely. The way the people dressed and their transportation and sheep and goats all over the place.
How was, can you elaborate on that? I mean, how did they dress differently? What was their transportation different?
Well, they dressed in gowns, I guess most of them, you might say, white gowns, it's almost street length gowns, most of them, and very, very simple, yeah, and they had they like to trade stuff to the Americans. I remember telling about this. They'd be in a jeep, and somebody wanted to trade him some apples or something for, they wanted to trade him their gown or something, I forget how it was, for apples or something, so the GIs would tie the gown to the jeep, and then they'd pretend to hand them the apple and take off, and they'd have their gown with them, and they had, still had their apples with them too. Yeah, but it was different. I know. I heard him tell. We were a short time, a short ways out of town, and then some of the guys went in to town on the pass, and they rode in these kind of rickshaws. They had donkeys on these carts that pull them on buggy-like vehicles, and a couple of them ran together. One was going, one was coming, I guess, and they ran together or something, and they got off and got in the fight, and one guy stabbed the other one and threw him in the ditch and got in the rig and went on.
Oh, wow. How did they generally receive new Americans when you got there? I mean, was it friendly or, you know?
Well, I never really had much contact with them in that area at all. But as far as I know, they were glad to see him, and like I said, they liked to trade stuff, so stuff they could get, Kodaks and pencils and different things that they were after. They weren't careful, they'd steal their shoes. Cigarettes, of course, is a big item for trading, and chocolate bars.
And what all did you guys do in North Africa while you were there?
Well, we just did a little training, basic training, kind of, when we were in Casablanca there for about a week. And then we boarded a 48 train and for a trip up to Oran. And there was a prisoner of war camp there during the war, and we stayed inside this camp. It was fenced in all around, and the authorities told us the fence wasn't there to keep us in there, it was just to keep the natives out. But after a few days there, it wasn't very long, then we moved from there up to our zoo beach, which was on the Mediterranean, on the beach, and we operated out of there for several weeks, if I remember rightly, and practicing beachhead landings and stuff like that. I know we used to go out on these landing barges and circle around the ocean there for about an hour, about a mile out, and then we'd go for the shore and land and disembark and make a landing, pretending, and got sick many more times.
Yeah.
Circling around out there. Cause you get about 25 guys in one of the landing barges, and one of them would get sick and start heaving, and it just go right down the line.
Oh, I bet.
But while we were there, we had to be careful too there, because people, like I say, you put up some camouflage tent kind of material for making their latrines, and you didn't watch them at night, so they'd disappear. they'd take them, they'd steal them. But I don't know, one time there was down on the beach there, and the captain was along, and some of the other officers and some men, and somebody had come and got a hold of a Tommy gun for some reason or other, or somehow, and was firing at targets out in the water, and so it come my turn to shoot the gun. got him and started shooting, and was up the beach a little ways. Here comes the major. And then the captain, he says, "Here, better give it to me," he says, "I'll take care of it." So nothing happened as a result of it. But they used to go out there and fish sometimes and throw hand grenades in the water and explode and not kill the fish that come floating to the top and things like that. And then in town...
Did you eat those fish out of curiosity?
No, I
didn't. You just... Okay.
And then there, in town, our zoo, the naval, was a kind of a naval training station there. And they had every, it was every Saturday night or sometime, they have boxing eliminations. And we had one fellow in our outfit that was a pretty good boxer. Sergeant Parak from Pennsylvania, and he went in there one night and boxed to the area champion, the Mediterranean area champion, and actually had the guy licked, but the judges felt they couldn't give it to him. He had to give it to the champion, and he himself came over afterwards and told Parak, he said that he'd won the match with nothing to do about it.
So after you did your training, how long was it before you actually were shipped off to Italy?
It was in March. We went to Naples, yeah. We rode the ocean and went to Naples. And we landed in Naples. The war was, the front lines was just beyond Naples at that time. And
so you didn't have to do a beach landing then?
No.
Okay.
No. And we went in there and went to the outskirts of Naples area into a set up camp in an old volcano bottom. Down in there, but it was dead, I mean, and but not too far from Mount Vesuvius, which was spewing out some ashes at that time, came over our way. But we went in there and we stayed there for a few weeks, and then we went out from there. Then we went and moved on up to the area of the so-called front lines at that time.
That was when you went into combat then for the
yeah.
first time. What was combat like for the first time?
Well, it was about like you see in the movies, like I say. It was raining, and it was mud, and we were riding up in the trucks, and not really knowing where we were going or that, but it was at night, and this was the first taste of it. There wasn't a lot of small arms fire going on, but mostly exchanging artillery shells, and you kind of had to learn to know which one was coming and which one was going. Because they say the one you don't hear is the one that gets you.
Yeah, sure.
So we moved on and up into the front lines, and it was kind of a static area. That's the only thing that was really going on, like I say, was exchanging our artillery once in a while. And we set up shop there for, we were there, must have been there close to a month before we actually got into battle, yeah.
And your training
had
prepared you pretty well. You weren't scared, you say.
Yeah, and we still were doing a certain amount of training put out night outposts to keep an eye on the other side. And in fact, our first two casualties of the war were inflicted by our own men. The one sergeant platoon and his runner were going out. It was dark as could be at night, and they're going out to check the outposts. And one of them had stepped on a branch or something and cracked it, and of course the guy in the the foxhole out of the points, wheeled around and shot him, not knowing who it was. I couldn't see. But that they always teach you to shoot first and ask questions afterwards. But that was the first two casualties we had. There, another incident when there, one day on the front line there, there was a shell came in one of the houses where some of the guys were staying, and the one guy was trying to get out of the house, fell downstairs and broke his arm.
Oh.
But the shell that came in was a dud, so it didn't go off.
Oh.
But that was some of our first taste of what was going to be up against. Yeah.
How did the unit react to the first casualties being?